This is Connor McPherson. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer at OBL Marketing. Our team works with doctors all over the country to help them bring in more new qualified patients. We can help you build your website or fix your current one. We help practices manage their reviews and get more 5 stars on Google and health grades. And most important, we get you in front of more potential patients by helping them find you when they're searching and doing research online for treatments. We help grow some of the most successful practices in the country with a results-oriented, direct-to-patient marketing strategy that gives you an actual return on your investment. You can go and check out our website for more info as well. It's oblmarketing.com. We've got some great stuff on there, case studies and reviews from our docs who love working with us. And you can give me a call or shoot me an email to set up a 15-minute marketing analysis. I'll take a look at your website. I'll take a look at your online presence and talk with you about your marketing strategy to see where it can be improved. If you're wanting to do more UFE cases, GAE, PAE, PAD, veins, you name it, we know your industry, we know what it takes to win online, and we know how to make your practice grow. If you're already running your own practice or you're thinking about starting one, we want to help you. Go to oblmarketing.com. Let's take 15 minutes to see how we can help. That's oblmarketing.com.
This week on the Backtable Podcast.
I mean, I was just doing an assessment for a hand surgery practice, and they were thinking about, could we do our trigger finger cases in our office as an office-based procedure. And so I went out and analyzed for them how much they'll get paid for doing it in the office by Blue Cross versus doing it at the hospital. And that's better, right? But then I went out and pulled what Blue Cross is paying that hospital for the facility fees. And if they move these to the office, they're going to save massive amounts of money for the insurance company. And what I would like to see is use that for leverage so that you can get better reimbursement from the insurance company. But, you know, ultimately, it's not good for patients to have things done in the most expensive place because they're paying a percentage of it all.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Backtable Podcast, your source for all things interventional and endovascular. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and on backtable.com. First, a brief message from our sponsor.
This episode is supported by Reflow Medical, makers of high-performance medical devices for peripheral and coronary interventions. Reflow's approach to finding solutions to unmet clinical needs is known as the innovation algorithm, where physicians work with Reflow in a continuous loop throughout development. Successes include the Wingman catheter for rapid CTO crossing, the Specs LP, low-profile support catheter for improved vascular access and crossing, and Cora catheters, a suite of tools for use in complex PCI procedures. The innovation algorithm, products that are physician-imagined, Reflow-engineered. For more information, visit reflowmedical.com. And now, back to the show.
Today, we've got another great episode lined up discussing how to decide OBL or ASC for your private practice. We've previously discussed OBL business pitfalls to avoid with Terry Yates on episode 366. Please go check that out, as well as a number of different OBL and ASC practice styles and practice building topics that we've covered with physician entrepreneurs, including Jim Melton, Krishna Manava, Mary Constantino, Mike Watts, and several others. It's a hot topic, and today I'm going to be talking again to Terry, CEO of Accountable Physician Advisors, how to make an informed decision when making these decisions on OBL versus ASC. Welcome back, Terry.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And so for our audience who maybe didn't catch your prior episode, it was a popular one, and I got a lot of great feedback on my side. But just give a quick intro and tell them about your expertise in this field.
Sure. I started our consulting firm almost 11 years ago now. And initially, that was the focus, was working with private practices. We quickly started learning more about OBLs and getting into that space as well. 7 years ago, we added revenue cycle management as a service line because a lot of our clients had trouble with billing. And then since we started the firm, I'd say endovascular specialists make up about half of our business at this point. And we worked with 27 different clients on OBL projects, which include feasibility studies, de novo startups, optimization of existing practices, billing, all of those types of things. We pivoted to ASCs because what happened was when Medicare approved PCIs in an ASC back in 2019, we started getting a lot of inquiries from cardiology clients about doing an ASC. And initially, we were turning those projects down, but we realized as we looked into it further that the existing models for private practice physicians who wanted an ASC weren't that great for the physician. And so 2020, the pandemic happened, and although we opened 3 new OBLs that year, there was a little bit of a lull in terms of the pace of our business. We had a little bit of time to strategize. And so we started evaluating what it would take to get serious about doing ASC development, ended up partnering with a real estate development firm that specializes in that area, and started DocCentric Surgery Centers in 2021. So since then, 3 years forward, we've had a lot of momentum, and we've worked with 11 clients so far on their ASC projects. Again, feasibility studies, accreditation, optimization, and de novo projects. And, you know, I think the reason we've gotten that momentum is because we were solving that problem we saw in this space, which is most of the management companies that will help a physician do this want to own a piece of the facility. And so our model is fee-based and preserves all of the equity for the physicians. That's kind of our background and how we work on this.
Perfect. Thank you for that background. And, you know, another, I think, great background question is, for those who aren't familiar, what's the difference between an OBL and an ASC?
Sure. So a big part of it has to do with how Medicare sees the facility. So from Medicare's point of view, an OBL is just part of your medical practice. It's just a location, but it's typically integrated into the same location where you see patients for other things. In some states, it's permissible to structure it as a standalone clinic, but generally speaking, an OBL is part of your practice. And there are no special rules from Medicare for how you run it. The cases are billed in the same way that you bill all your professional services. For an ASC, it's a distinct facility. It's both legally and physically from your practice. And you can only bill for the facility fees for the surgeries and procedures that get done there. So Medicare has a lot of regulations for an ASC. They're encompassed within what they call the conditions of coverage. And you have to be inspected by the state or an independent accrediting organization to confirm compliance with those rules from Medicare.
Right. So it sounds like there's a lot more restrictions around opening an ASC, which we'll kind of get into, versus an OBL.
That is correct.
Okay. Would you say overall, grossly, it's in that case more expensive to open an ASC than an OBL?
Much more expensive for a variety of reasons. Part of it is that regulatory burden. Part of it is that you have to adhere to the life safety code, which governs the size of corridors in the facility and the space in general for the procedure areas. And so all of those additional requirements for the facility add up to a larger footprint and a much higher cost for construction.
Right. And we'll get into equipment and those kinds of requirements as well. But I want to get an idea of, you know, an OBL. A lot of docs just will throw a C-arm in there and some shelving and boom, I got an OBL, right? You can't get away with that with an ASC, right? Do you have to necessarily construct something for de novo, or can you kind of like take a space and, much like you do an OBL, convert it into an ASC?
Well, sometimes you can, you know, reno an existing space for your ASC, and that could save on some construction costs, just like you would for an OBL. A lot of people ask us if they could convert their OBL, their existing OBL, into an ASC, and most of the time that won't work because the footprint is usually not large enough to accommodate all of the requirements for the physical space and all of the extra things that you have to have. I mean, nobody tells you when you build an OBL that you have to have a specific locker room area with showers.
Right.
But there are things like that that are in the life safety code that drive up the costs on these ASC projects.
Wow. Okay. And so one of the key questions, I guess, is if an ASC is so much more expensive to build, are there significant reimbursement differences OBL versus ASC?
Well, there are. And I mean, at the macro level, ASC reimbursement is going up every year. And OBL reimbursement is driven by the physician fee schedule, and it's gone down every year. So for one, it's a long-term strategy to address these disparities in how you're reimbursed for work. But the reimbursement is very different in an ASC. In your OBL, again, it's just part of your physician practice. So when you send out a bill for a procedure you do in the OBL, there's one global fee that covers what the doctor did, the supplies, other facility costs like nursing, you know, the whole thing. And the insurance company and the patient get one bill. For an ASC, you're only billing the facility fees for the things like nursing and most supplies. So when the physician performs a procedure in the ASC sends a bill to the patient and the insurance company, but the physician still sends a bill from their private practice for their professional services. So that's one of the big differences in the reimbursement schema. You're not allowed to bill for diagnostic imaging services in an ASC. You know, imaging that is integral to the procedure being performed is included, but that's a difference. And the major reimbursement difference is that in an ASC, Medicare only reimburses you for the primary procedure code, which is very different than an OBL. So when you do an endo case in the OBL, you might be billing for several additional codes for things like ultrasound guidance for access or additional territories treated or IBIS. And in the ASC setting, those additional codes are bundled into the primary procedure code. Now, sometimes you could negotiate with commercial payers for them to reimburse for more than one code, but that's highly variable. And for the most part, you're billing just the one major code. You know, as of this year, Medicare's reimbursement is more favorable in the ASC for most endo cases. But as you can imagine, in some clinical situations, if there were a lot of add-on codes, it might not be as lucrative in the ASC as it would have been in the OBL. So it's a case-by-case scenario.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. Thank you for answering that. Because, you know, we had Jim Melton on probably like a year ago. It's been a while. We like to do periodic reimbursement updates, and where him and Blake Parsons come on, because Jim can give us the update on the vascular surgery side, more with the ASC reimbursements and then PAD. And then Blake gives us a reimbursement update on the embolization cases, right? What we commonly learn is that it really is different in the OBL and ASC, depending on what cases you're doing. And so one of the docs out there in the OBL community, Preston Smith, was asking, when does an ASC make sense for people outside of peripheral arterial disease?
Well, a lot of the improvement in reimbursement this year was around the peripheral vascular cases. And so if you are in IR, you do really need to dig into the details, because some things, embo cases are still reimbursing better in the office setting. So it's very much situation dependent and has to be analyzed.
Yeah. So what we commonly hear about is the hybrid, right? So that kind of tees up the next question. What is a hybrid? What are some of the rules for a hybrid, and how could a hybrid be beneficial?
So a hybrid basically means that I've got the same facility. It's constructed to meet all the ASC standards, but certain days of the week, I'm going to operate it as an OBL instead of an ASC. And there are a lot of rules that you have to follow if you're going to do that from Medicare. Some states don't permit it, but, you know, a lot of them do. And so, you know, Medicare doesn't want two different enrolled entities operating in the same space at the same time, because it confuses their beneficiaries. You know, they want them to know, is this an office copay or an ASC copay? What is this place I'm coming to? So you have to separate the days. You can't do OBL cases in the morning and ASC cases in the afternoon. So you have to define, okay, it's an ASC Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and OBL Tuesday, Thursday, for example. Because they're separate legal entities, you also have to maintain a separate medical record for your patients in the ASC. So you can share things like space, equipment, you can even lease staff, but you have to have a standalone database and medical record for the patients of the ASC. Medications have to be owned and stored separately for each entity. So, you know, there are a lot of little details like that that you have to follow, but that is what people mean when they say they're going to operate a hybrid facility.
Okay. And so, like, what's the advantage of that? I mean, why would you want to deal with all those logistics to operate as a hybrid?
Well, you know, a lot of doctors look at that and say, okay, certain cases reimburse better in one setting than the other. This is a way that I can selectively put people in the place where I'm going to be reimbursed best. You know, I get that inclination, but based on what we just discussed about how the reimbursement works, sometimes it's a little hard on a complex case to know in advance how many add-on codes you would have had. So it's not always easy to predict that, first of all. And importantly, my attorney friends that specialize in this area have some concerns about CMS seeing that as cherry picking and, you know, downstream there being problems because of that. So for us, we say there are two really good reasons to consider a hybrid. And the first has to do with just offering a different level of care, right? You can put, you know, certain patients in an OBL, but not every patient is going to be suitable for that setting, either because of the type of sedation that arrangements that you have in that versus your ASC. There may be patients that their underlying medical status, you know, is a little bit less than you would like for the OBL, so you'd like that higher level of care, or just to comply with Medicare site of service rules, right? It may be that we're going to do certain things in our OBL, but, you know, we would like to create our open fistulas in this ASC facility instead of going to the hospital, which you cannot do in an OBL.
Right.
The other big advantage to a hybrid is it solves one of the financial challenges, or helps to address one of the financial challenges with starting an ASC, which is the timeline for credentialing and to get reimbursed is much, much longer for an ASC than it is for an OBL. So you could operate it part-time as an OBL while you're going through that extended process of accreditation and credentialing for the ASC. So you're generating some revenues that are helping the cash flow that while you are waiting for that ASC piece to hit. And so that is one of our, in our view, one of the best reasons to do it that way.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, this was kind of the crux of the conversation, but I mean, you've got docs coming to you of all different endovascular specialties, and they're like, Terry, I hear there's a lot of talk about these ASCs, OBLs, hybrid. How do you help them determine what's best for their situation?
When you're thinking about doing any type of big project, new practice startup, ASC startup, OBL, any of it, you need to hire someone who's qualified to do a feasibility study. And so a feasibility study is, for an ASC, involves researching what the state-specific regulations are, because they do vary by state. So, you know, you may need a CON, a certificate of need, if you're in certain states, or there may be considerations about what types of procedures are permissible. Some states allow coronary procedures in an ASC, some do not. So the first step in the feasibility study is figuring out, you know, what's the regulatory limitations that we have to be aware of. And then it also involves analyzing the reimbursement for the proposed types of procedures, projecting case volumes and expenses so you can estimate the profitability of the thing. And that's, you know, one way to figure out, is this the right decision for the practice? And then, you know, you have other things like, am I willing to commit the amount of capital that's required to build a facility to ASC standards? You might say, hey, even though reimbursement would be better, it's not better enough to justify the additional investment. So those are all things you kind of work out in the process of evaluation. Although I will say that for some people, what we try to factor into that evaluation is other potential benefits of the ASC, because it's a standalone facility. And if it's a state where you don't have to get a waiver and only use it for your own practice to avoid a CON, you might see this as a way to partner with physicians that are synergistic with your practice. I mean, if you are a PAD specialist, you can't exactly easily integrate podiatry into your practice situation. But if you do a lot of work with podiatrists and you build an ASC, maybe they could also be surgeons who are participating in the ASC, which can strengthen those relationships.
I see. So they're not necessarily investing in the ASC, but you could offer, hey, here's a space where you can do your cases to your colleagues.
Or let them invest in the ASC and participate.
Okay, got it. I mean, that's a great strategy as well, yeah. And there's no laws around that in terms of, I mean, it's a multi-specialty practice, that's what you're describing, right? Essentially.
Right. So there are different legal safe harbors that keep you compliant in an ASC, and the rules are different for a single specialty ASC versus a multi-specialty ASC. But if a multi-specialty ASC makes sense for you, then you can have physicians of all different specialties participate, which helps both maybe in terms of the overhead expense of the endeavor, but as I said, also just creating strategic partnerships.
Right. I mean, I just visited Krishnan. We'll talk about his space here in a little bit, but it seems like that was his strategy. So, okay, well, is a certificate of need always required for an ASC?
No. In some states, there's no CON rules at all. So speaking of Krishna in Ohio, we don't have a certificate of need requirement, so we were able to just do the project. Some states have a certificate of need that is very restrictive. Some states that have a certificate of need have exceptions. You are doing an ASC that's only for your own practice. So for example, in Georgia, you can basically notify the state, look, I'd like to build this, but it's single specialty. It's only for one practice, and they'll give you a waiver of the CON requirement. So it's different in every state, and it's complicated. So if you are in a state where there's any CON element, either obtaining one or obtaining a waiver, you really have to hire an attorney that is specialized in CON work in that state. That's kind of how to get that done.
Yeah. And I imagine you've been sort of building that Rolodex as you take on clients and can advise on that sort of thing.
We have a great guy that we work with on a national level that's really good at structuring these deals and really understands the OBL space, Jason Grace. So Jason will typically point me to who is the CON guru in a given state that he recommends, because it's very local. You really have to have someone who understands how the local CON board functions.
So let's talk a little bit about the real estate strategy, right? Because, like you mentioned, I mean, OBL, you could rent a space, pop a CRM in there, you know, be good to go in a few months, it seems like. Whereas an ASC is a whole different project. And I've seen docs, usually it seems like they're buying and building with an ASC. But tell us a little bit about what you've seen that works and what has not worked in terms of real estate strategy.
Well, you're right. When we were only doing OBLs, we had clients who had strategy all over the place. You know, some would say medical real estate's a great investment. Why would I pay rent to someone else? And they just build. But a lot of times for a startup, people would lease space. And sometimes you can do that very cost effectively. I mean, when we did Krishna's first practice in OBL, we found an imaging center that had been decommissioned. And, you know, we basically popped the CRM in the room that used to have the CT scanner. And for a very modest reno budget, we were up and running. That's fine in situations like that. But where you're doing a full new build out for an OBL, or especially an ASC, where you're putting a significant amount of money into the tenant improvement, the concern about leasing is you would make a huge investment and that at some point a landlord would not renew your lease. And so, you know, most of the time for that level of investment, you want to own the building so you have control of that.
That makes sense. And then also, if you were to do a whole build out of an OBL, I mean, I guess my question is how often are you seeing people come to you now saying, hey, I really want to convert this OBL to an ASC? You know, where do you start with them?
So if someone has an existing space and they want us to evaluate it, you know, we look at the floor plan and we can normally help our client figure out quickly if there's any chance. If you're going to seriously pursue it, we think it looks good, but we want to seriously pursue it, then there are people that specialize in doing life safety inspections, looking at that code, and we would get them engaged to just do an official review to see if it'll meet the standards. But, you know, from a starting place, we just take a look at it ourselves, and we normally can tell if it's going to fly. One of my consultants in the ASC company, he's a surveyor for one of the big accrediting bodies for ASCs. So he goes and inspects places regularly. So, you know, we kind of know through his expertise what's going to work and what's not.
Okay. I have a question about staffing OBL versus ASC, because, you know, this contributes to cost, of course. You know, do you need more people, for example, in an ASC versus an OBL? And then on our last conversation, we talked about people problems. Are people problems better or worse in an ASC or OBL, or is it all the same?
Well, I have observed wide ranges of staffing models and OBLs. And so in some cases, especially states where there's little or no regulation of the OBL, you might have to have more staff to meet the conditions of coverage or the standards of the accreditation organization in your ASC. In some states, you already have to have accreditation for an OBL, or the state is pretty prescriptive about what type of staff have to be present. And so there may not be a change in the staffing that's required. So it's definitely dependent on what the OBL situation looked like from the start.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then, so I do have some questions from our physician entrepreneurs out there, docs who are building both OBLs and ASCs. I'm going to start with, we've already mentioned Krishna a couple of times. I had the opportunity to, I was home over Christmas break, so I got to stop by and see the new build. They'd just been in for a week, him and Mamdu, and they were doing cases. And so Krishna gave us, my wife and I, the tour. It's pretty incredible. I mean, it's a beautiful facility, first of all. But he's got one door that is OBL on one side and ASC on the other side. And it's pretty unique in that he's like, I can literally just go through this door and do my ASC cases and come back and do my OBL cases and go back and forth. And it was built purposely for that reason, right? Because I know you were part of the whole process. Can you talk about the design behind that and you know, maybe people can learn from that if they're trying to recreate something like that?
For sure. Well, that's been an incredible project. He started with the vision and said, I'm not going to do a hybrid. What I want to do is have a facility where I have my private practice and I have an OBL. And then instead of sizing up that OBL next to the practice, I want to build an ASC. And his purpose in keeping those distinct was probably in large part because he saw the ASC as being a multi-specialty facility where he could have that synergy with other people. And so my business partner in DocCentric Surgery Centers, the real estate company is called Noon, N-O-O-N, Development. And so we sat down with Noon at the beginning and said, how do we make this whole project very interesting and strategized? And so what started with the idea of Krishna building a building where he would have his practice and have an ASC, we instead built a very large building. I think it's 45,000 square feet or something similar.
It's huge.
And it's two-story. And so we have his practice in the ASC in the building, but we also have a podiatry group that's a tenant in the building, and they plan to do cases in the ASC and be investors in that. His wife's practice is ophthalmology, so she's got her ophthalmology practice there, and she'll be doing her cataract cases in the ASC. But more importantly, Noon was able to go out and source for the main floor of the building an enormous primary care practice to go in as a tenant. And so we got 16 primary care physicians on the main floor of this building that are, you know, now in a great position to refer their patients to the specialists on the second floor and drive traffic. So this is one of the things that really helped in terms of having a professional real estate developer instead of us just trying to hire an architect and tell them what to build, is we had someone who could help us do a strategy to make the whole project a lot more interesting and valuable.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful facility, and I recommend anybody who's, you know, thinking about building anything, whether it be an OBL or an ASC anew, to go check it out if you're in Columbus. You know, those guys are very proud of it, and I'm sure would be love to give you a tour. I told him, do you remember that show MTV Cribs, where people, like, you see like famous people's homes, right? I said, there needs to be that for medicine where you're showing somebody your new ASC or your new facility, because the tour was great, and it's really neat to see people building unique structures like that that are really, I mean, pushing the envelope, right? And I mean, I had the same feeling when I went and visited Jim Melton and Blake, and they built this whole hybrid facility and have, you know, multiple specialties working together. It's something very unique and different. And so I love seeing that. And he did have some more questions for you. He felt like these would be helpful for the audience. Unlike an OBL, can out-of-network patients be treated in an ASC?
I mean, well, you can do out-of-network patients in your ASC or your OBL if there's some reimbursement and you choose to take that lower reimbursement. So once you are fully licensed and accredited, so you've got permission from the state to operate because things are safe, could you see patients out-of-network? Sure, absolutely. And there are some ASCs around the country that are built, they're only out-of-network and they do all kind of out-of-network and cash pay work. They don't usually do that well in the long run, but there are some people who pursue that business model specifically.
And I had this question from a couple of docs. Can you see consults in an ASC?
No. The ASC is only for surgical procedures. And so back to how does the billing work, right? You have to keep your clinic completely separate from your ASC. You can't have the same office suite have your clinic operating or your ultrasound department operating and having patients come in at the same time. So, you know, you have to have a separate waiting room and a separate entrance if you're operating your ASC at the same time you've got clinic going on, you know, nearby, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. And for the audience, because this was a common question. So, and people are wondering, how do you create something where you can get away with that? And it sounds like that's really what Krishna's created, because he can see patients on the OBL side in clinic and then go over to his ASC the same day to do procedures, right?
And that was part of his strategy. I mean, you can do it different ways. You know, let's say you're going to do a hybrid. You could have one big kind of suite and have it oriented so the area where you have your procedure rooms, your recovery, all of that is, there's an easy dividing place from the rest of the practice. And as long as you have a separate waiting room and a separate door, kind of cordon that off and still be running your clinic on the same days. In his case, he's got a completely separate suite, has its own waiting room and everything. And for him, you know, listen, one of the advantages of that is a lot of physicians are thinking about exit down the road. How do I monetize the value I've created in my practice? And while some say, well, I'm going to sell to private equity someday, that means you're going to now become an employee of private equity and all that goes along with that. And so if you create a separate, distinct ASC that's its own legal entity, you know, you could someday decide to sell that without it impacting your practice. You know, you take some money off the table by selling your ASC. You could still do cases there, of course, because of the convenience, but you're not now an employee of someone else. You've still got your practice intact.
That is a great point, because that kind of ties into one of Mary Costantino's questions, where she wanted to know that everybody seems to want a piece of an OBL or ASC. You know, you mentioned private equity, but like her question was sort of, what do you see as the role of mom and pop shops, like what she has and what Krishna has going forward? It sounds like docs still want that autonomy, but you're saying that you could even, if you get to a point where you're not selling your practice, you're actually just selling the ASC and it's two separate things, right?
That's right.
That's incredible flexibility.
The big management companies that are in the ASC development business will partner with you right from the start. But when they do that, they're going to take a big piece of the equity right out of the gate. And when they become a big owner in the facility, they're also going to obligate you to a long-term management agreement with, you know, for billing and everything else. And we see that as a multi-million dollar mistake. And the reason is, you as the physician are the ones that are creating all of the value in the entity. The management company isn't really creating that value. Now, why do doctors go into the arrangement with them? It's mostly to get capital for the project, or because they're worried that they don't have the expertise to do it. But inevitably what happens is they get a few years down the road and realize, you know, you're paying a lot for those management services and you have no room to negotiate on that because they're permanent. And also, you know, you're taking an equity level haircut. So if you're someone like Krishna, you started on your own, or as Mary's calls it, a mom and pop shop, and you work with someone like us, you know, we're fee-based, so you keep all of that equity. That doesn't mean you can't sell down the road to a big management company, and they'll gladly buy you out at that point. But now, when they're buying you out, they're paying fair market value at the time of the buyout for all that value that you created in the entity as the physician.
Right. You're the one that built it and brought all those other specialties in that are regularly doing cases there.
Your own cases, you know, your own cases are instantly creating value in the place.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's one of the big questions that Mary had, because, you know, this whole cost of ASC just seems huge compared to the OBL. Even converting, you know, when does that extra investment in an ASC actually pay off, was one of her big questions. I know it's kind of hard to nail down, but
it can pay off a lot sooner. I mean, some people are building their private practices with an eye toward private equity. And, you know, listen, everybody's got different priorities, but our client base come to us because they value their independence and they like not only financial control, but also, you know, just control of their day-to-day activities.
Yeah. Let's say that somebody does want to find investor partners. How do you go about the process of finding a surgeon investor partners? I mean, do you guys, I imagine you know the space well, you know who's involved. I mean, maybe there's a lot of docs that are out there doing really well who want to invest in other ones to keep it physician owned.
So a lot of times our clients come to us, they've already put together a coalition of, hey, we've got these groups of docs have gotten together and we want to do this project. So we're doing an ASC right now that is for, you know, three different groups that are coming together to do a multi-specialty facility. Sometimes we help the client think about who might be good investors and we'll help them do some research on that. Obviously, that's called syndication, is when you're selling the shares and bringing in investors. And you have to work with your attorney that's ASC experience. So that's the kind of thing I do all the time with Jason Grace is, okay, we're doing this project, but we need to set up the partnership structure for the physician investors. And so that's what that process entails.
So everybody wants to know your crystal ball long-term. Do you think OBL reimbursements will continue to decline and ASCs will increase and we're going to see more of this trend? You know, based on what you've seen and what you've heard to the grapevine, what do you predict in the next 5 years?
I predict that ASC reimbursements will continue to increase. That's just based on looking at historically how these fee schedules work. I predict a lot of uncertainty around the OBL reimbursement. You know, I'm worried that if history continues the way it has, that it's going to be more and more difficult in that space. And so I think having a long-term strategy makes sense. The wild card is, does somebody at CMS ever wake up and realizing that they're pushing people to move services back into the hospital? So, you know, could something come through? I mean, obviously there's legislation at any given time trying to fix these issues. And they don't just affect endovascular specialists. These reimbursement issues affect other people that do procedural work in the office. So it's possible that those things are going to be corrected, but who knows? So that's my answer, is I think there's uncertainty in the OBL space, but if we look at history, it's not going to get better. It's going to continue to get more difficult, but ASC fee schedules seem to go up every year.
You know, we have the ENT show and I hear my wife and her co-host talking about, you know, there's this whole push for office-based procedures in ENT, right? Getting out of the OR, doing stuff that's more basic in that you can do in the office, but then they're worried again about the reimbursements dropping on those. So you're right, it's not just endovascular, right? It seems to be, they're catching on to all this office-based stuff and worrying about it being abused. And so one of the big questions was like, can physicians who want to do office-based procedures, can they have any influence on these driving forces of decreasing reimbursement?
Well, obviously, there are groups like the Cardiovascular Coalition that are working with members of Congress trying to correct these issues. So physicians, you know, joining OEIS, donating to things like the lobbying firms that are helping, those obviously are meaningful. Continuing to make people know about these things and educate the public about these things. I mean, I was just doing an assessment for a hand surgery practice, and they were thinking about, could we do our trigger finger cases in our office as an office-based procedure? And so I went out and analyzed for them how much they'll get paid for doing it in the office by Blue Cross versus doing it at the hospital. And that's better, right? But then I went out and pulled what Blue Cross is paying that hospital for the facility fees. And if they, you know, if they move these to the office, they're going to save massive amounts of money for the insurance company. And what I would like to see is use that for leverage so that you can get better reimbursement from the insurance company. But, you know, ultimately, it's not good for patients to have things done in the most expensive place because they're paying a percentage of it all.
Right. Fantastic. And speaking of OEIS, your team's going to be talking about this more with docs at the upcoming OEIS meeting, right?
Oh, yeah. So we're doing a special event on Thursday evening, which is, you know, there's a bunch of special courses on Thursday during the day, but the main session opens Friday morning. So we're hosting an event in our suite at the Paris Las Vegas, which is where the meeting is being held, from 6 to 8 that evening. And basically, they're going to be our team and other legal and real estate experts who specialize in these ASC projects. So, you know, we're going to have sushi and cocktails, and basically people can just drop in and talk to us to get more kind of consultations about some of their questions. So if your listeners are interested, please contact us and check that out.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. I mean, I always preach about the OEIS meeting. It's a fantastic meeting, great people, multi-specialty, always fun. So everybody should definitely look into that. Also, Terry, we're at the hour. It flew by. Any other tips for physicians considering an ASC or converting to an ASC? How can we read up on this? I know they can reach out to you and learn more, but how can we learn more, you know, on our own? Are there any good resources?
Well, there's the Ambulatory Surgery Center Association that is basically ASCA, and that's an organization that helps independent ASC owners, and there's some good information there. It's pretty inexpensive to join, and so they've got a website that's got a lot of good stuff. That's a place to learn. You know, my biggest tip is only hire companies, and that's attorneys, architects, consultants, for your ASC project that specialize in it, because the cost is so high. If you make a mistake, it can be really catastrophic from a cost perspective. So get someone who really knows what they're doing if you're doing a project of this magnitude. And I guess my other tip would just say, as we've been discussing, if you want, there's an opportunity potentially to sell your ASC in the future, or even if you have no plans to sell, just if you're bringing in additional physician investors later down the road, think in the very beginning about future valuation as you're planning. So, you know, that would be, you know, thinking about, am I creating only the amount of capacity that I need right at this moment, or am I keeping some capacity in the plan for future growth? That'll boost the value of the center. Who are the investors in the project? If you have, you know, if everybody who's an owner in it is really close to retirement when they build it, and there are no younger physicians that are going to have a lot of longevity, USPI is going to say, well, you know, if I buy it, they're going to retire, and where's the case volume going to come from? So, you know, having diversity and the investors can build the value. And then obviously for multi-specialty centers, the high dollar cases that are hot right now are, you know, in cardiology, PCIs, spine, and total joints. And so having a facility that will accommodate those things is going to boost the value of your ASC in the long run.
Wow, that's great. That's good to know. I mean, just one last thing, I mean, because that was one of Christian's questions. I mean, it sounds like multi-specialty or planning for multi-specialty will increase your overall value long-term. But what if somebody just, they're not thinking about that, they just want to serve whatever it is they're doing. I mean, what's the cost difference and what's the time difference in terms of planning and execution?
It's easier to execute a single specialty, and you are going to have less cost, right? Because you're not going to have the need for different types of equipment. You know, if you're a vascular surgeon that's only doing PAD work, you probably can do just fine with a mobile C-arm. Even if you introduce cardiology into that equation, which is a very common partnership. But, you know, if you're going to do coronary work, you need a fixed imaging system. So that's a huge step up in terms of cost. Obviously, there's specialized equipment, you know, if you're doing cataracts that you have to have if you're adding something like that in. And so it is more expensive to do multi-specialty, and that's part of what you have to tease out in the planning process. Is that worth it? Will the case volumes that come in these other areas make it worth it?
Perfect. I think it's a great place to put a pin in it. Anything else, Terry, before we finish up?
No, I've really enjoyed the conversation, and obviously I'm passionate about this topic and I'm immersed in it every day. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk to the audience a little bit about what we've learned.
Yeah, thank you so much, Terry. And again, the audience should go check out episode 366, where we talked about more about, you know, business pitfalls to avoid. So a good combination between that one and this one. We did focus a little bit more on just getting off the ground and running in that first one. So if you're just in the idea stage, probably good idea to start with that. And then, you know, I think we'll be producing some more content here soon with Terry as well. And definitely check out OEIS and go to that happy hour.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck, Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manveer Singh Subli.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.